Is the consent agenda, and we have a request to remove item D1 because it's actually not complete. It would be added to the next agenda probably. So if the motion of approving the consent agenda could include removal of item D1, please.
Okay, anything else, Golden? Richard?
Okay, I would then move we approve the consent agenda with the removal of items D1.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Chris, would you poll the council, please?
Councilmember Cardoza?
Yes.
Councilmember Christensen?
Yes.
Councilmember Laraway? Council President McPherson?
Yes.
And that motion carries. Business items, item 7A, confirmation of funds for annual Easter egg hunt coordinated by Sherry Russell through the Lions Club. Chris Ingles.
Mayor and council, Sherry Russell had contacted our office. She wanted to confirm that council still wanted to support the Easter egg hunt with $2,000 again this year. And she will not be subject to an SCP through the city because she's on school ground property, and so that would go through them. For us, it's just the financial donation to the cause. I stand for any questions.
Okay. Any questions from council?
Mayor?
Yes.
I think last year, after the Easter egg, usually I get involved every year with the distribution. Last year, when I talked to Sherry, it was canceled. And I think all the candy was distributed through the schools, the elementary schools.
That was my understanding.
Yeah. So basically, even though there was no Easter egg hunt last year, the candies did go to that age group that traditionally would have had it. So.
Okay.
Okay. Then I would, and you said it was 2,000, Chris, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I would move then we approve the expenditure of $2,000 for the Easter egg hunt.
Second.
All right, motion is made and seconded. Is there any further discussion?
Mayor?
Yes.
If I could ask Bill. Bill, since I am active every year in this Easter egg hunt, should I abstain from voting?
Mr. Mayor, members of the council, in my opinion, the ethical issue might be that you do not eat more than $50 worth of candy. But other than that, I think you probably are okay.
Thank you, Bill. You made my day.
And that's why he gets the big bucks.
The big bucks.
All right. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion carries. Item B is consideration for $15,000 from general fund contingency for the purchase of shade and walled tents to be used for city facilitated events and programs. Chris Ingles.
Mayor, council, Bobby and I had actually discussed this previous to the budget for this fiscal year. However, neither one of us included it in our budgets. And so the goal was to obtain tents that will provide shade and walls for city facilitated events. We have kids events, the Ranger program. We have different kinds of festivals that occur, those types of things. So I stand for questions, as does Bobby.
Okay, questions for Chris? How many of those is there?
For the record, Bobby Withrow, Parks Director. The one that we are looking at, it should get us a 20 by 60. We could actually add to that moving forward. So if we feel like we need more in the future, we can just buy the same structure and just add to it.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Mayor.
Yes.
If I could have the floor. Bobby, the Parks Department over there in Orchard has a big garage in that house that we have. Could that be used for storage?
That garage is currently full. And that is actually the next item.
Okay.
So I will answer that question when we come to the next item.
Okay.
Anything further?
Okay. No. All right. I then move we approve $15,000 from general fund contingency for the purchase of shade tents for events.
A second.
Motion is made and seconded. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? That motion carries. Item C, consideration for $35,000 from the general fund contingency for the purchase of a large storage shed to be placed at the parks office for city event and recreational items. Chris, were you reporting on that one too, or Bobby, you want to, or?
I'll take this one, Mayor. For the record, Bobby Withrow, Parks Director. So we have officially run out of storage in the Parks Department. Yes, at our office, we do have a nice sized garage. It is currently filled with 22 tables, 153 chairs, 20 cornhole boards, 3 golf carts, and a bunch of other stuff that I can't say off the top of my head. So we are running out of storage, and we're getting bigger every year. And we're adding to it, and everywhere we can stuff we have, and we just can't anymore. So we need a bigger facility for that.
Is there room for it in the police station? Never mind.
No. How big of a building?
No, I don't think we want to know.
How big a structure are you looking at?
Looking at the tough shed quotes that we got, we should be able to get at least a 20 by 20 or a 20 by 40 back there.
Sweet.
So we're looking at something that size.
Okay. Anything further?
For the record, Bobby Withrow, Parks Director. Sorry.
You've got him trained well, Chris.
Okay, well, looks like everyone's good with that. So then I would move we approve $35,000 for the purchase of a large storage shed from general fund contingency.
I'll second.
Motion is made and seconded. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion carries. Item D, consideration for $100,000 from contingency for a storage building to be built at the North Wastewater Treatment Facility. Paul Stevens, I see we have you online. You may have the floor, sir.
Paul Stevens, 751 West 4th Street, City Engineer and Public Works Director, for the record. Did I do good? The prices of all our buildings are going up and up and up, so I requested $100,000 so we can complete this project in this fiscal year. And the table that Richard requested last time is at the bottom of the page. So the original budgeted amount was $30,000. The amount requested is $100,000 for the contingency and a total of $130,000.
Okay, questions for Paul.
Richard, good.
I just want to make sure that it emphasizes which contingency it's coming out of.
It will be water and sewer.
Water and sewer?
Yes, sir.
Could that be noted to?
Yes, we can certainly do that in the motion.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay.
Anything further?
Okay, I then move we approve $100,000 from the water and sewer contingency funds for the construction of a storage building at the North Wastewater Treatment Facility. Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? And that motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Item 8A, consideration to approve ordinance number 2021-06. This is an ordinance of the City Council of the City of CUNA, amending Title III CUNA City Code by the addition thereto of a new Chapter 10, providing for daycare licensure, requiring a daycare license, adopting state code definitions, provide for types of daycare licenses and fees, providing for license application, investigation, license term, city clerk issuance, denial and revocation, providing for license application, denial, appeals to city council, order to show cause hearings before city council for license revocations, declaring it unlawful to engage or conduct or operation of a daycare without a license, and establishing a punishment, directing the city clerk, and providing an effective date. This has come on the tails of some issues that have occurred in the city here over the past several months. This one I would like for us to go ahead and take to the three readings so that we have time for input if people would like to make comment on this. Basically, I don't know, Chris gave a pretty good description of what we're doing. If you would want to go ahead and go over that. One thing that we were very careful with was not stepping too deep into what Department of Health and Welfare does and that type of thing, but yet give some protection for the citizens and their children. Chris, go ahead if you would.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. The purpose of this is to identify a special class of business license for daycares. In the past, they've been grouped in with the general business licenses. Not unlike alcohol, there are alcohol licenses. There are certain stipulations that they're required to meet, as are food. Daycare will be no different. They'll need to comply with all the state licensing requirements, which include background checks of all employees, of the owners. They're required to keep up on vaccination of the children. They're required to make filings. They have inspections. So for our portion of it, as we do with other licensing that has a bigger umbrella with the state, we'll require that they provide us copy of compliance with state health and welfare for daycares. If they cannot provide that, then we will deny. If they continue to operate a daycare without proper licensing from us, then we will have the option to cite them with a misdemeanor for every day that they refuse to license properly with us and the state. The fees will remain the same as other business licensing, $24 for the initial, and then it'll be $10 for 1-year renewal. We will not do multiple year renewals on daycares. We will do just single years so that we make sure that we stay current with their compliance with health and welfare. I stand for any questions.
Okay, questions for Chris.
Yes. On the pre-existing daycares, they're going to have to follow under this.
That is correct. They'll be notified.
And the licensing is separate from the state license of health and welfare?
That is correct. It's the business license. So for them to operate a daycare business within the city, whether it's a home one or an actual center, will require this compliance.
How do we judge the compliance?
They have to be in compliance with the health and welfare. So the state does all the background checks. All of that's public information. And I have spoke with them, and we can definitely work on a partnership, but all these daycares will have documentation and be able to provide proof.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mayor, I may.
Yes.
Question here. Chris, you mentioned that each day they're out of compliance, they can be charged a misdemeanor for every day they are out of compliance. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's the same statute that we have in all the other business licensing.
Thank you.
Yes. Could I have the floor? Chris, is this a duplication of what the state is doing? Why are we duplicating what is already in existence?
We're not duplicating, sir. What we're doing is, previously, they have been able to obtain their business license just as a commercial business, if they were a center or a home occupation. And then they would just go through the basic process of land use, building sign off, and fire sign off. However, like alcohol and others, any restaurants, there's a overlaying entity. So we're actually requiring them to provide us proof that they're in compliance with the state before we will issue them a business license for a daycare. They're already required to have a business license for their daycare. Now we're just asking that they provide proof like we do all of the bars and the restaurants.
Are we going to mandate compliance by going out to each one of these daycares? Or are we leaving that up to the state?
That's up to the state. When they license with us and renew with us, they'll be able to provide us with their licensing compliance from the state. Not unlike Central District Health provides a certificate for the restaurants. ABC ISP provides a license, so does the county for alcohol. It'll be the same process.
Would our acceptance be before the state or after the state?
After.
Okay. I don't. Okay. It just seems like duplication of what the state's doing already to me. Just another license to be issued if we're not going to complete any kind of compliance. We're leaving that up to the state. What are some of the problems we're having now with daycare that we're looking at an ordinance like this?
Without getting too far off track, we've had illegal behavior between an adult and children. We have had overcrowding of daycares. We have had a death of a child occur. We do receive complaints and concerns about daycares being operated in areas that are not fenced, those kind of things. And typically when we are looking at those things, we have found that they are not compliant with the state. And this is an attempt to have their licensing, their business licensing that they obtained from the city, that they show us proof that they are properly in compliance with the state, with state of health and welfare, for the safety of the small children that attend these facilities.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, anything further on that? So that's why I wanted this one to go through the full three readings so that we can have time to digest it and see if we come up with any other issues and that type of thing, so. All right.
Mayor, I'm sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
Is this, before we issued them a business license to begin with, did we have no recourse or way of confirming they were compliant with the state before we offered them the business license to begin with?
That's correct. As the code currently states, we wouldn't have provided, we wouldn't have required them to provide proof.
Thank you.
Follow-up question?
Yes.
If, understand now that if something goes wrong at the daycare, they notify health and welfare, or the parent does. But if the parent comes to City Hall and now complains because they're under our license, do we turn it over to the chief of police or do we send them back to health and welfare?
We have yet to determine the protocol. We would need to talk with the chief. We'd want to talk to health and welfare. At the end of the day, we believe that if somebody calls us and complains, that we take that complaint, we give them their options of who to complain to, and then typically we will duplicate that complaint to make sure that any entities are informed. The more grievous the matter, you know, the more we're at that, for sure.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anything further on that? Yes, Mr. Gigray.
Mr. Mayor, members of the council, just by way of explanation, and I understand as you're asking, this would just be the first reading of three before you consider approval. What we're looking at here, and I assisted the mayor and the clerk with regards to the drafting of this ordinance, is one of the first things we took a look at was with regards to what ability would you have to regulate daycare if you determined that you were going to get into the safety and health regulations of daycare that the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare has a responsibility to administer under the state code. And the law allows cities to do that, but you have to match or increase those requirements over and above what the state mandates and the Department of Health and Welfare is promulgated by their rules and regulations. Most cities that I've checked on have not engaged in that unless they're pretty large and have a large administration to deal with issues like that. And I think in this instance, the main issue is one, the state would remain the primary jurisdiction. They're the ones that would issue the license. The license for daycare would have to be held by the daycare operator in order to have a business license in the city of CUNA under this, or they would be subject to a loss of their license, business license. Your jurisdiction then, as chosen by this proposal, would be your authority to do business licenses. And the main thrust of this is one, that you want to assure that any daycare that you license using your business license authority is one authorized by the state of Idaho and holds a currently valid daycare license from the issued by the Department of Health and Welfare. And two, it's my understanding, and Jace Hellman can explain this in more detail than I can, that they hold a special use permit in order to run it, which I think is required for all daycares operating in any zone in the city. And so if there are violations or complaints on behalf of people who are using a daycare, or parents or otherwise, that some of these standards are not being met, then of course, if the clerk receives that, she's gonna refer that, if it's a conditional use permit issue, to planning and zoning to look at potential, whether there's a violation of the conditional use permit
as well as the Department of Health and Welfare. Once it looks as if they're in that they're found in violation or they lose their license, then you can proceed to revoke the business license that they hold. But it gives, it's kind of an additional authorization on behalf of not only planning and zoning, worrying about whether or not they're complying with conditional use permits, but also with our business license authority and regulation to assure that they're complying with the state licensure requirements in addition. And you have authority under the Idaho code to license businesses, whether it's door-to-door sales or whether or not it's any other kind of business that's required to have a license. Now, whether you choose to regulate in this regard or not is a matter of your discretion.
Question for the attorney.
Yes, go ahead.
Putting this under the licensing business of daycare following health and welfare, does that not open us up for more liability if something happens and health and welfare doesn't respond or for whatever reason we end up involved in this?
Mr. Mayor, members of council, I don't believe that there would be a valid claim against or claim against the city in such a regard, because the license responsibility for health and safety standards is a responsibility of the Department of Health and Welfare, not the responsibility of the city. Now, if we engaged in the full regulation, then I think that question might be answered differently.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that. All right. So that's just the first reading, and we will bring that back on the next agenda for reading number two. We don't have an executive session, so we're to mayor council announcements. I have a couple, three things here. So the Patagonia East Ridge and Lakes, there was a denial on an annexation on that. There was a request made to bring that back to council. And because it was an annexation, so we denied the annexation, which made the discussion on the preliminary plat and all of that, that discussion was rendered moot. So we, since we denied the application for annexation, when there's a request for a reconsideration on annexation, we've had those in the past, and basically we bring them up and did anybody change their mind yet? No, and then that's it. Then we move on. There's no decision or anything. So there's nothing in the, annexation isn't governed under the Local Land Use Planning Act, whereas the preliminary plats and those types of things are. So it's really not, they don't have to wait a whole year before they can bring back a request for an annexation. And since the preliminary plat and the rest of that was deemed moot, we really haven't affected that because we haven't made a decision on that. So in this case, I, after speaking to our attorney, decided that it wasn't really of good use to bring those back to council every time when it's an annexation. So the applicant would just have to bring that up again and go to planning and zoning, and they don't have to change their plan or anything. They just have to reapply and go through that process again. So most all the legwork is done on those, especially in the preliminary plat part. So it doesn't create a lot of extra effort and time on them. So in this case, I had decided not to put this on the agenda. However, if council feels differently and you would like to hear those come back, we can certainly do that. If you disagree with that idea, we can have it put on the next agenda and bring those back for your consideration. But so I guess that's kind of where we're at there. I just denied that being put on the agenda for the night, and if you feel differently and want to look at annexations again after we have just denied them, then we can certainly do that, but I didn't really see the point of it. We've done a couple and it just created an awkward pause and then we moved on. So
I think with the complexity of the sewer issue, knowing nothing's been done to really rectify any of that, I'm not sure what it would change. I mean,
well, and to that point, they are they have come to the table. They are working on fixes for that, and I think they're well into discussions. I think they've come up with a plan on that. There is some more work to be done. Easements need to be procured and that type of thing for the project to occur. So I think once Paul has finished looking through all of that and everybody gets on, the developers were very quick about getting together and
I'm sure they were
working with Paul and trying to come up with a solution to that. Obviously the Main Creek, Mason Creek trunk line was supposed to be the fix-all for everything. And that's what they're discussing now, looking at rights of ways through that. And then also determining if that truly is the fix-all. And if it is, then that's the way they go. And, but we could be looking at a 3-year timeline to get that in. So they're also looking at some other solutions that might take a little less time, but meanwhile working on that large project. So once it's determined and locked down that that is the proper solution, then the rest of these things can come back into play. So that was what I decided on that, but I wanted council to know that, because it is ultimately would be your decision. If you would like to hear those again, I'm certainly happy to bring them back, but the way those had gone before, I just kind of didn't see the point in it. So,
yeah, I mean, I think Councilman McPherson said it. It's a situation that I think you're going the right route. I think you chose the right route with that, just because when it will come back, I think we're in the exact same boat we've always been in. So it's something that, if they go through planning and zoning and start that route again, it can answer a lot of questions if needed there before it gets here. So,
well, I think that's good, because then it gives Public Works time to reevaluate and come back with information and say, yeah, we can, exactly, we can serve that. And I think it just puts it into the process again and it's more complete, whereas before there was a lot of questions. So yes, Councilmember Larway.
If I do remember, I think the whole bottom line came down to the lift station capacity. That's all it was, if I remember right.
Well, and piping.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the lift station and the piping was
getting the product to the plant.
It
yes.
wasn't a bad product. It wasn't a bad layout. It
right.
Was, we
right.
couldn't service.
So right.
If the city engineer can work this out, in the meantime, I don't see any reason why I shouldn't move forward with it.
Right.
That's just my opinion.
Okay. All right. Yes, Bill.
Bill Gategray, City Attorney, 5700 East Franklin Road, Suite 200, Nampa, Idaho. Sorry, I think I left that out in the last comment. And I'm the same person that spoke earlier in the council meeting. This particular request, and it was a letter addressed to the mayor and to the city council, and the mayor asked me to review it, and we discussed it, and I rendered my opinion for him. He has issued a letter to Mr. Heath Clark, who I believe is in the audience this evening. I know he is. He represents the applicant. I was authorized by the mayor to send a letter back. Basically, the analysis was, as the mayor has discussed, the particular applications that were before the council on this were for an annexation and then for a preliminary plat. And since you denied the application for annexation, Your second order rendered it, the other application moot because you have no jurisdiction to decide a preliminary plat that's not within the bounds of the city of CUNA. So, Mr. Clark, who is a very adroit lawyer, made a request for reconsideration of that and for a mediation. There's actually two requests, and the last letter, which was February 5th, was actually for a mediation. In my opinion, both those requests, if they're based in law, would have merit if this were an issue over the preliminary plat, because it's under the Local Land Use Planning Act of the state of Idaho, but the annexation statute is a different statute and it's not in the Local Land Use Planning Act and therefore is not subject to the requirements of reconsideration on denial or mediation. Now, if you chose to do that, I'm not saying you can't. It's just my advice to the mayor was there really is no basis in this. And from an administrative standpoint, from my point of view, if you start facilitating requests pursuant to LUPA law for annexation denials, for reconsiderations, or for mediation, I think you're going to start down a road of expectations of any other denials on annexation, where if somebody is going to come back and make those requests, and if you don't grant them, they're going to feel like it's not been fair because you've done it for one and you've done it for others. So at this point, and the mayor wanted to know what his authority was, and I believe he has authority to set the agenda, that he had the right to not include it in the agenda, but you should report it to the council because we have a request that's both to him and to you as council members, which he has done this evening. So at this point, if you do want to put it on the agenda, you can ask the mayor to do so, and then he can follow up on that. It's not an action item. I think you'd have to individually view what you'd support and not support. It's not listed as an action item this evening, so it's going to have to be more about what you'd like to see happen as an individual council members, because that's part of a discussion, and I don't think that violates the open meeting law. The matter could go back to staff and with the applicant, and if they have a basis upon which they would like to have the council review this matter again, my preference would be that it would come through a recommendation of the staff to bring this back on the table for a consideration, but not pursuant to the LUPA law. As a matter of a staffing of this particular matter, and it's now ready to come back, and we're not setting any kind of a precedence that we would recognize a right of reconsideration or of mediation when you're making a decision to deny an annexation. So that's probably about as clear as reading a Supreme Court decision on civil procedure, but basically that is where my advice came from. And I did have a chat with Mr. Clark, and he is of course concerned for his client. He's doing a good job for his client. That the actions that the mayor has taken in this regard and myself and advice is really an administrative concern and process. It isn't any animosity with regards to the particular applicant or this application. So with the mayor's permission, I'd stand for any questions you may have, but that's what led us to the point we are now and why this is in the announcements of the mayor and the council.
Okay.
What did you say?
I don't know.
I did my job.
You said Supreme Court.
My question is, do we as a council, there was conditions of acceptance or rejection, I guess, previously. Can we as individuals approach the engineer department to see if any of those conditions have changed since our last, or does it have to be in a public venue?
Mr. Mayor, members of the council, and Councilman Cardoza, good question. My recommendation is don't do that.
Okay.
These are quasi-judicial matters, and about the time that we have council members having individual conversations with staff about the merits of a particular application, you're setting an opportunity to create bias and potentially being challenged later on. So I wouldn't recommend that happen at all. In my mind, I would say this discussion, of course, is, I think, being heard by staff this whole thing, because they're all taking part in this meeting. And so, I think they can take that information back, and certainly the applicant may want to have a conversation with them about what could be done at this point in time, and they could take a look at the merits of that and make a decision about whether they wanted to bring this back on their own.
Let me reword my request, Bill. What I meant was, overall, as to our facilities throughout the city, could I approach the city engineer to see if our overall system has been improved or worked on? Or I think we have an engineer looking at it at the present time as to efficiently update some of our lift stations. How much latitude do we as a council have to approach the city facilities on questions that are not dictated to a specific request?
Mr. Mayor, members of the council, I think as long as you're just asking for overall information about an entire system and you stay away from any particular applications for purposes of just learning about it, and also not directing the engineer or the public works director to do anything other than provide you with general information about the whole item, and you're very clear about that, and I would have an audience of more than just you and them, I think you can do that, unless the council makes a decision that you want to restrict council members from that. One thing we always try to be careful about is the chain of command. And of course, the mayor is the one in charge of all of the personnel. And so I think you would want a clear permission to do that with the mayor, because he's in charge of all personnel. And you don't want to get in a position where you have, and I've experienced this over the years, where we've had the chain of command kind of gets eroded because we've had elected officials spending time with staff people, and then that information comes back in the meeting and it looks like one elected official is getting more special information than the rest of them, and it really erodes the integrity of those people. Now, what I think is the best approach is for the council to direct the public works director or the engineer or whoever to provide you with a workshop of where are we here and what are our capacities and whatever, so that information is shared, you identify what it is you want. I think the other way you can do it also is that you could do an email to the mayor and say, I would like information on this from a particular department head, and then that can be reviewed by the mayor and screened, and then once, and if he thinks we got a legal issue, he'll ask me, and then that goes to them, they answer the questions, and you get it back in writing. And I think that's a cleaner way to do it.
And so, specific to this subject, but not this development, where we're at with that right now is they're assessing what needs to happen with the facilities and the pipelines and that type of thing, and what easements need to be procured, and make sure that this has actually the appropriate fix. Once we are pretty certain of that, then we'll have a workshop where Paul can address the council and let you know where we're at with that stage, so that moving forward, any other subdivisions or annexations or anything of that sort that come to council, you'll be better staffed on what our abilities to serve are. And so we're not quite through that process. It's been a bit challenging. There's a lot of pieces to it, more so than just how big of a pipe it needs to take to get from here to there, but a lot of right-of-way issues and the Mason Creek drain that runs along some irrigation systems. And so getting all those permissions to make sure that fix can even happen has been kind of the challenge. But I think we're getting close there. And I think once we talked about it shortly today, but I think that once Paul gets that put together, we'll come to council with an update on that, so you know better where we're at. And Paul is very specific, being an engineer, and he doesn't like to give generalities. He likes to give facts. And so until he has things locked down pretty solid, there won't be much update. So that all makes sense, kind of.
Clear as mud.
Yeah. Supreme Court.
Supreme Court.
Thank you, Bill.
Let's see. Oh, the next council meeting will be our Board of Corrections. So we're going to start a half hour early for that one. So the council meeting, Board of Corrections, would be at 5:30, and then 6 o'clock would be the regular council meeting again. We are looking at, so for Compass, we're looking at our population will more than likely come in at above 25,000 this time. Those numbers will be, I believe in April is when they put those out. What that means for us is that we will no longer be a small urban city in their eyes. So there's a couple of things that happen there. Right now I am the representative for small urban cities on the executive board. I won't be that anymore because I won't be eligible. So that will go to Garden City or Star. It will provide me a full-time seat on the executive board. And then the other thing is, it will provide us one more seat on the Compass board at large. So I will need one council member that is willing to be on the Compass board. And it's not something that you have to attend all the time. We can have substitutions, so we can pick as long as we let them know 48 hours in advance, we can have a staff member attend for whichever council member in case something comes up and you can't make it to a meeting. But we do have to get those names in an official manner so that they know who it is. And so we have a little bit of time, another month or so, before I have to decide who that is. But anyway, that's where we are with Compass. It seems like there was something else I was going to say, but I can't think what it is. So legislative issues. Senate Bill 1108 with regards to property taxes has been moving along, but it's kind of stalled. I'm not sure that they have the votes in the Senate to pass it. Some senators have even said that they are growing weary of the legislature trying to take away the local government's ability to collect funding and to fund themselves in a reasonable manner. So I'm not sure that it's as popular of an idea as it was sounding like it was in the beginning. So we'll see where that goes. We're still watching that one pretty close. There's quite a few of them out there. If council has any questions or any concerns on any of these bills that you see coming up or hear rumors about, let me know. I'll get you connected with the people with the Association of Idaho Cities on our legislative committee, and you can be in part of those conversations if you would like, so that you can sit in on the meetings and hear what's being said about them. So, but there's been quite a bit of action up there this year, and I'll be quite happy when the legislative session is over this year. So that is all I have for tonight. Did anybody else have anything on discussion items you wanted to mention?
Mayor?
Yes.
I did, as a downtown merchant, I did have a conversation with the postmaster about getting a blue box downtown for mail deposit. There is one at Paul's or Albertson's, and he says the mail there is very minimal, and if he could, he would try to get that relocated downtown. The problem, which I don't understand, to move the box has to be okayed by Denver.
Well, that makes perfect sense.
Our postmaster can't just take the box and move it. It's got to be done by a higher authority. So we've got a couple of locations that have been offered downtown, but until he gets the authorization from Denver, the blue box will stay at Albertson's, but he was hoping on within a few months being able to relocate it downtown. So
be nice if they could have a couple of those in town, but I don't know, that probably creates more of an act of Congress than moving one. So.
Yeah.
So. Okay. Yes, Mr. Gigray.
Mr. Mayor, Bill Gigray, city attorney. Just on the legislative note, it looks, as I see it, House Bill 73, which is a transparency bill in the uniform accounting and reporting and moving our reporting from the legislative services over to the state comptroller and a uniform a manual that will decide through promulgated by the comptroller's office of the state to be affirmed and approved by a legislative oversight committee. Looks like that's probably going to make it through. I don't know what your information is, but so we'll be watching that. And I think that's kind of a delayed implementation, because I think they have up until there's a 2022 date that part of it goes into effect, which switches it over to the comptroller's office. And then I think they have a 5-year implementation on the uniform accounting part of it. House Bill 197, in my mind, is a disaster. I hope that is not going anywhere. I don't know if you know, this is the one where the legislators proposed to eliminate the ability of cities and counties to establish criminal offenses for at a misdemeanor level, and is limiting it to a $25 civil penalty for one violation, and two is a $50 penalty. I know there's been traffic for the Idaho Municipal Association attorneys on this, and we've been gathering and providing information in opposition. In my mind, it really would be a real disaster, because number one, just think how many ordinances you'd have to rewrite, because I think it puts in doubt whether they'd even be enforceable. Number two, what happens when you have someone that doesn't comply with one of your ordinances, let's say a major development? Well, what do I have to pay any attention to this? I guess hooking up to water and sewer would be the biggest part. But a violation, they'd only get a $25 fine. I mean, this is just crazy.
Cheaper to pay the fine than it is to deal with the issue. So,
and I think the other thing you'd take a look at is, what do we need a police department for if we can't have any ordinances to enforce, and the state's going to, we have state law, we'll let the state police do it and the county sheriff. I mean, hopefully this thing gets stopped. And it sounds to me like a legislator who's not from this part of the country just doesn't have a lot of background. And I think that legislator was upset about some of the COVID-19 ordinances. So the proposal is to come in with a bludgeon. So hopefully that gets defeated. Another bill that I think is a great one is the recreational immunity bill. And I think that's House Bill 131, if I'm not mistaken. But that one really, as you know, we have a statute that provides for recreational immunity. So if we own property and we allow people on it without charging a fee for recreational purposes, there is no liability if they get hurt or, you know, something happens. So this bill broadens the definition of what ownership rights are, and it also broadens what recreational activity is. And, you know, it can include, if we had a license agreement for a pathway somewhere in the city, I think it also eliminates some of the arguments that canal companies and irrigation districts come up with when you want to use their roadways for also a pathway for recreational purposes, saying, well, we don't want the liability. Well, if we don't charge a fee, there is no liability. And so I think Bobby's watching that one. I think it's really good for cities, and the Water Users Association sponsoring that bill, and that's a huge lobby. So I think that's going to make it through.
Seems like it. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and there, you know, some of the ones that failed, like, so the not having to do publications in the newspaper. You know, we were just, Jared had just mentioned today that our budget for that is $30,000 for publications, and it looks like we're probably going to have to increase that budget this year. So one of the main arguments they had on that was that the press keeps a portal that is statewide so that you can go there and pick out any legal publication you want to find, you can do that. Well, cities also have websites that you can get those things off of. So what we might try next year, and I think I'll suggest to our legislation, our legislative committee for AIC, is if Association of Idaho Cities is willing to take on to put together a portal that guides you to each city's website so that you can find those within each city's website. That takes care of the portal question. So I don't even know how many people buy a newspaper anymore, or I don't even know how many people ever have looked at a legal publication in a newspaper anyway, but I think it's probably a very minimal number of people that get it that way. We already put them on our website, so spending an extra $30,000 a year or more is I think that's something we need to bring up again next year and see if we can't get that taken care of. But it's been a strange session this year. It's gone in directions that I'm like, I don't know. Started out where they spent most of the time in the first couple of weeks picking on the governor, so that was good for all the rest of us. It gave us a break. So but that poor guy. Yeah.
Mr. Mayor, sorry, just one more point. And this is on Senate Bill 1108. And of course, we've got not only you folks, but we have a lot of other local government clients that are dependent on property tax. And of course, we've had the recent annexation into the Napa Rural Fire District of the whole city of Napa. And the problem, one of the problems with Senate Bill 1108 is, how will it be administered and how does it read? Does it exempt overrides? Does it exempt? Are they still exempted under the limitations of the property tax, or is the way it's rewritten? It's kind of ambiguous. And I know our office, as we've even contacted Zach Wagner, who's the comptroller of Canyon County, who we worked with for years and years and years. And this, we've asked him, you know, looking at that bill, how are you going to implement it? Answer is, we don't know. And I know Senator Rice has some thing he's submitting that's going to be how this is going to be administered. But we're also aware that due to the acrimony that has kind of existed between the governor's office and the legislature this year, that state agencies are not providing any information to any of these Senate and House committees on any of these bills unless they are specifically asked by a legislator. Which means that normal line of communication, it appears to me, is broken this year to a significant degree. And my point in looking at that, and I sent, a memo to the mayor's received, my concern is there's enough ambiguity in that bill I'm wondering, without an opinion from the state's tax commission as to how it will implement that bill, you don't know the answer to what you're looking at. And with they have an effective date of July 1, which is the standard an effective date for legislation, unless it's an emergency or they've delayed it, is July 1, 2021. Well, in order for you to get, if you needed an override, in order to get it in the next fiscal year, you have to have a special election in May. That day's already passed.
Right.
And I know from my many years of working at this, and you don't really know what your property tax number is until you get the L2 worksheet from the county. And that's going to tell you what your allowed increases are. And what's going to drive that under a new bill, just think, that bill is going to pass here, if it does, in March or April, whenever. Then the state tax commission is going to have to review it, and it's going to have to provide advice to the counties about how it's going to be administering, because remember, the counties can't send out L2 worksheets that the state tax commission won't honor, because then they'll throw it back. And I've had situations where I've had arguments with the state tax commission about whether you can get a tort claim levy over and above your levy limits, and we run into those more often with fire districts, particularly when we had all of recession time. And their interpretation of the statute and mine was different, but that'll control unless you brought it to action. So my point was, even if the Senate was wanting to pass this bill, at a minimum, they should have an effective date of July 1, 2022, not 21. So if we now know what the state tax commission is going to do, and if there's a mess, you've still got another legislative session to correct it. But quite frankly, I think there's so many ambiguities, and I think there are other things that they could look at for property tax relief. One of the areas is assessment process. That's a whole different area of the law that they haven't even talked about, that I think there's a lot of opportunity to do some give and take there to provide some tax relief, because that's really where a lot of the issue is. And part of it's a shift of a property tax burden from commercial to residential, which is pretty significant. But if you can imagine, if you had a piece of property worth $100,000, assessed taxable value, $100,000, and you had a levy rate of 1.5, you're gonna pay $150. But if that same piece of property is worth $500,000 and you had a lower levy rate of 0.001, you'd pay $500 in property tax. And the law is very clear, and I have appraisers that contract with counties to do appraisals for assessed valuation purposes. And the state tax commission administers this as well. And counties have to keep their property assessed every 5 years. It can't get older than that. And the state tax commission gets on the counties.
They try to do 20% per year just so they can keep up with that 5 year
mark. Exactly. So you may not sell your property. You may be a retired person, you know, and you're going to stay in it and you're not selling it, but your property values in a market like this are going to go out of sight. And your property taxes will probably increase because your assessed valuation increases, not necessarily because the property tax levies have increased. A lot of them, as you know, go down. So in my mind, the legislature is even looking in the wrong direction for this whole thing. And
well, for some cities, that tax shift between residential and commercial is substantially more. It's not as bad in CUNA because we have a 90-10 split. So there's not as much commercial to throw that onto. However, it still is happening. But Boise City, they're 50-50. So you know, in Boise, that's substantial. When property values go up, it goes on to residential and comes off of commercial. But you're right. There's so many other avenues to look at, and you know, the allowing for schools to collect impact fees. I think I figured that out just last year. That would have been if it was $5,000 per home, that would have been $4.5 million. The school district in CUNA alone could have collected to help pay for facilities. And so that's allowing the new growth to help to pay for itself somewhat and taking that burden off of having to go for bonds and things like that when you're coming to pay for new facilities. And dang it, just the legislature is required to provide for education. So they want to sit there and say that they're going to provide tax breaks because they have an $800 million budget surplus this year. So they're going to make tax breaks, but local government, we're the devil because we're not providing tax breaks. Well, it's not, we don't have that extra cushion in there to do that with. So we're trying hard here. I know, last year we didn't take a 3% increase, even though we didn't qualify for the governor's property tax relief program because we didn't have, just because of our system. But I think we're doing a good job with what we're doing, and we're trying hard with it. And they need to look at other avenues. There's some really good ideas that have been brought forth to them. And I think that had they brought local government to the table when they had their interim committees throughout the year, I think they would have done a better job with their legislation, especially on that piece. But we weren't provided a seat at the table, so we get what we get. And I don't think it's as popular of an idea as it sounded like it was going to be. So hopefully it will go away and something will come up again next year, of course, but maybe by then we can convince that we need a seat at the table to help with it. So anyway, well, that's kind of all I had for tonight. If nobody has anything else, then we'll call this meeting adjourned. Thank you all very much.